Welcome, everybody, to Health, Wealth, and Divine. My name is Jawanza. Thank you so much for your patience. It's a beautiful day, and I just want to say Happy New Year to everybody. This is the first show for Health, Wealth, and Divine for the new year. First show in January for us, and I can't think of a better person to kick it off than a regular on the show. Again, we're very, very fortunate to have someone as a regular on our show with expertise, knowledge, wisdom, and just as important as all of that is experience. Okay, when we bring you people, we want you to know that they know what they're talking about. And we've all heard the phrase, experience is the best teacher. And that's probably true. Well, let me put it this way. I mean, caveat, successful experience, okay, is when you're learning from somebody that's been successful in their experiences, and they may have made some mistakes along the way, but they learned from them. And with that in mind, our special guest today has written a book. It's called Entrepreneurial Success, 105 Business Principles, The Road to the Top. This is the fourth edition, and for all of you entrepreneurs out there, you know I'm talking about Professor Joseph T. Geiger. As I stated, we're very fortunate enough in our entrepreneurial section to have someone that's got over 50 years experience as an entrepreneur. So we bring this information to you so that you can be successful in your entrepreneurial endeavors and that you can avoid a lot of the pitfalls that many people just starting out make. So for those of you who are unfamiliar with Professor Geiger, let me tell you a little bit about him. Currently retired, Joseph Geiger grew up on a Kansas farm and graduated from the School of Business at the University of Denver. Over his lifetime, he has started over 10 businesses, two of which predated his college graduation. And after his second retirement, he taught entrepreneurship and small business management. And in order to help people like you and me, entrepreneurs, succeed in business, he wrote Entrepreneurial Success, 101 Practical Business Principles, and the book just keeps growing. Subtitled The Road to the Top, and so we are very, very, very fortunate enough, again, to have him as our special guest. And kicking off the program for the new year, Professor, welcome back to Health, Wealth, and Divine. It's always a pleasure. Can't wait to get into this great interview today. Professor? Are you with us? Okay. Well, Professor, I see you up there, so I don't know why the it's not letting me hear you. You're not on mute on my end. Please check your phone to see if you're not muted. And if not, please try the number again. It's 347-359. Let's start that over. It's 347-324-5727. Again, that's 347-324-5727, Professor. So if you don't mind hanging up and trying back in, then I can bring you on board. Everybody, again, my special guest is Professor Joseph Geiger. Again, we've been doing this series for several years now. And for all of you who are entrepreneurs, you can go back into the archives and scroll through the archives, and you can see all of the shows that we've done with Professor Geiger. We've actually going through the book principle by principle, chapter by chapter, so that, again, you can take advantage of the wisdom that he's garnered over his years as an entrepreneur. I mean, and he started all kinds of businesses. I mean, so, again, when you hear his story, you'll see why we're listening to him. And, you know, when it comes to being an entrepreneur, you need a roadmap. Many people are starting their first business. I mean, like, you know, Professor Geiger, he's done it over 10 times, okay? But there are many people that are starting their very, very first business. And so you need someone to show you how it's done. You know, there's a way to do it. So you know what? Instead of me waiting, Professor, I'm going to give him a call, okay? So everybody, if you don't mind, be patient. Here we go.
Hello.
Okay, Professor, you're on the air.
Yeah, great.
I don't know why I
could. Well, there we go.
Yeah, we're ready to roll.
Okay.
Gave everybody, awesome bio. Your history as to how you got started You know, starting off on a Kansas farm, and you know, going to be getting into the weeds a bit. You know, so that's okay. I mean, we had a simple everything. I mean, we're talking about entrepreneurship here, isn't that? Everything's not as simple as, you know, 1, 2, 3, ABC. So today, we're going to be talking about legal and ethical issues, and we'll be starting off with principle number 47. But before we do, I'd like to ask you a question. Someone asked me to ask you, and it was actually concerning an LLC. This person had multiple businesses, and they were wondering whether or not they could form all, use one LLC or combine all of the their businesses. I don't know how many businesses they were talking about, but it was more than one. I mean, they were asking me to ask you, could they combine those several businesses under one LLC, or does each business need its own individual LLC?
Well, actually, you can do it either way. And there's some advantages in each having their own, and each is separate. If one goes down, it doesn't bring the others down. With a pretty well-known example is President Trump had a business in Atlantic City, a casino, and each of his businesses are on a separate LLC. So when the whole thing in Atlantic City collapsed, his and virtually everybody else's, his casino collapsed, but it didn't affect his hotel chain. So there's some pluses to it of having each one. There's some minuses in that each one you have to go through the, you know, there's some small costs if you do it right. There are very, very minor costs. You can go online and incorporate, and there's a one that's I've used several times. It's Incorporate 39 or 39 Incorporate, I can't remember which, but it costs you $39 to incorporate. And then in addition to that, you have to pick a state and incorporate in that state, so there's some state costs. Here in Virginia, it's $100, so if you did it in Virginia, it's $139. And then if you want them to do all the busy work, as it were, it's another $60. So, you know, I've done it quite a number of times, but I've gotten kind of lazy, and rather than my doing all of the detailed paperwork, I just paid them $61, and so it cost me $200. And I've had several of my students do it. I recommend the same thing for them, so it costs you $200 here in Virginia. Some of the states are more, some are less, so that's how it is. And you certainly can run various businesses, a lot of businesses that are different under the same one. But remember that if one of them gets into financial trouble, you can't just suddenly incorporate that one and think you're going to protect yourself, because you won't. What they'll say is you did it in premonition of the bankruptcy, and the judges won't let you do that. I mean, they'll set that aside very quickly. So those are the first and last. As long as you stay really up on it, there's no reason why you can't have a variety of different businesses being operated under the same incorporation.
So if one goes, if let's say one business goes down, then could they attach or, you know, put a lien on the assets of any of the other businesses under the that same umbrella?
Yes, sir. Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Unless you had them each separately incorporated, and then when one goes down, it takes its own corporation down, and that's gone, but it does not affect any of the others.
Okay, gotcha.
So, yeah. So okay, however you want to do it, it's just remember that is a problem, and if you have it all in one and you see one is getting weak, well, you better incorporate it quickly and hope that it'll last just fine for a minimum of over 6 months to a year. In California, if you did it 8 months out, they probably would set it aside, and you'd be stuck with all of the the corporation that survived, the one going down, would get stuck with all the bills, and so you need to be a little careful of that. But that's the choice you make, and the pluses and minuses.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I'll pass that along.
Yeah.
Well, actually, I'll have the person actually come back and listen to the show so that they can get the your full explanation on that. Thank you.
Okay.
Again, today, everybody, we're going through the professor's book, Entrepreneurial Success, 105 Business Principles, The Road to the Top. We're in the fourth edition. We're going to be talking about legal and ethical issues. We actually started that. The last show we did was in late November, and we started that. We moved into that chapter then, but we'll be picking up from where we left off. Let the other guy write the agreement. Let the other guy write the agreement. Anytime you're serious about entrepreneurship or you're getting into business and you're dealing with lawyers and attorneys, I mean, ultimately, they're going to be contracts that come up. Professor, before we actually tackle 47, could you just talk for a moment about the importance of getting things in writing and understanding contracts? Because you're going to see it if you're getting into business. You're going to either, you're going to come across contracts and agreements, and we know that unless it's written, it's not binding. Could you talk about even the importance of making sure that when you're doing business that you do have contracts before we actually talk about?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. The word contract is a legal term, so you want to make sure that you understand what a contract is, and rather than just me doing it off the top of my head, I'm trying to look it up very quickly. But there's seven different requirements for a contract. And they all have to be there. It's spelled out in my book, and I'm not finding it. And I'd rather than do it off the top of my head, I'll just say that you ought to go to the book and read what a contract actually is, so that you understand it. Because there's seven things that are required. And let me have a go at it, and maybe I can get most of them. But a contract is an agreement between two or more people. It is over a period of time for, I'm not getting it. I'm missing too many parts. And one of the parts is there has to be consideration. So, for example, when I was selling yachts and airplanes, when we sold an airplane, you had to fill out an FAA certificate for it, and it asked what the cost of the airplane was. Well, a lot of the people didn't want that to be public knowledge. I mean, it wasn't anybody's business but theirs. So we always put in it was $1 OVC, other valuable considerations. And so there has to be a consideration or money being exchanged,
mm-hmm.
and it doesn't make any difference whether it's $1 million or $1. $1 is consideration. $1 million is consideration. And as far as the law is concerned, it doesn't make any difference which you are. But you as a person going into it, you ought to read that, because I spell it out very, very succinctly. I hit all the important issues on it. And let me look one other place here and see if I can find it very quickly. But that is very, very important to understand what a contract is. And if you don't get it right, there's only two ways of getting it. You can get it right or you can get it wrong. But you surely want to make sure that you understand what a contract is and make sure that you hit all the spots on it.
What if you take somebody that says, well, you know, I'm going to have an attorney, and I'm going to have my attorney review it anyway, so it's more important that he understands what it is than me understanding what it is. I mean, and I say that only because there are people out there that will not read the contract. They just figure, well, I'll have my attorney go over it, and he'll advise me. So as mm-hmm. long as he understands all of that, then, you know.
Well, you need to understand it. And what I used to do is when somebody, we had to do a contract or an agreement, I would always tell the person that, well, you know, I'm just a little guy here. I'm just getting started or you know, I don't really understand these things. So why you have the big attorneys and you know all about that. And why don't you write it? And the reason I did it that way is because I wanted them to have the opportunity to try to cheat me, because mm-hmm. I wanted to know whether or not they were going to do that. And most business people won't. I mean, I've had lots of business people when I sold things that were expensive, be them airplanes or yachts or businesses, that would come back and say, hey, you made a mathematical error. I hate to do this to myself, but I just cost myself $3,500 because you made a math error, and it should mm-hmm. be that much. And that's been very common for me. So most people are honest, but I want to give them the opportunity to try to cheat me, because
right.
When we got it back, I would read it over carefully. I'd give it to my attorney to read over carefully. And then if we found something, then what we would do is I'd have my attorney redline the changes he wanted to make. And then I'd take it back to him, and I said, well, this damn attorney, I don't understand why he did this. But, you know, I gotta do what he says, because that's why you mm-hmm. hire him. And I would badmouth my own attorney and give it back mm-hmm. to him and see. What I wanted to find out is if they're really crooks, then what they'll do is they'll take their hidden thing that they were going to trip me up on and just put it in a different spot. And hopefully it will get through that time, or put it in different words, but it'd be the same thing. And if they did that, well, then the next principle after the 47, let the other guy write the agreement, the number 48 is some deals are best left unmade. And that would be one of them. And I've done that a number of times and walked away from a deal that, you know, I could have made money on. But if you're dealing with a crook, he's always going to be a crook, or she, as the case may be. And I want to know that up front. And the way to find out is give them the opportunity to be a crook, and then you're really looking for it. And usually you'll find it.
Do you ever find it interesting how people can easily look at you, talk to you, pretend to be honest and upfront and, you know, moral and ethical, yet at the same time, I mean, based on your experiences with this particular principle, giving them the opportunity to trick you, and them actually taking that, biting the bait, you know, taking the bait,
yeah.
but at the same time smiling at you, being very friendly and cordial with
you.
That's amazing.
Yep.
That's amazing. How people can do that. They have the ability to look you in the eye, smile, shake your hand, be very warm, and they're going to come across as very, you know, ethical, yet at the same time looking at you as a potential
chump.
Victim.
Yep, they sure did. And so that's something that I have done for a long time in an effort to make sure that I did not get hit that. So I'd look at it and then find out, well, they thought they were going to get me, but I didn't get them, but I have no interest in getting them. I only have an interest in coming out of this thing in one piece. And so I would that's how I would do it, and I would strongly recommend that others do it the same way.
Wow. Again, so that takes us into the 48th principle. Some deals are left undone. I remember
best
in
left,
the book,
yeah.
Talk about a deal with a lady. I believe it was with a yacht, a boat you were going to send to sell her or something, and then you saw from her demeanor, her attitude, that this might be some issues going on here that's down the line that I can already see where this is headed if I do this deal with her. Could you talk about that particular that instance with our listeners?
Well, actually, it was a guy, and he wanted to buy a boat, and we talked about it over a period of time, and he said he was selling his business. And so as soon as he sold it and he got paid for it, well, he would come down and buy a boat, and we'd build it just the way he wanted it. And so he called me one day and said, yep, I just cashed the check. I'm going to be tied up for some time here. It was the early spring, and the guy had a wholesale business of cigarettes and candy and small stuff that he wholesaled. And he so he came up and he spent 2 days, and so I talked to him about how he sold the business, and what he did is the nature of a wholesale business, it's kind of a steady as you go business. If you want something with explosive growth, wholesale business is not it. I mean, that just doesn't happen. Once in a great while, one of them will hit a product that really takes off, that's new and takes over the market. But the vast majority are not that way. And what that guy did is he set it up, and he started about 18 months ahead of when he wanted to sell, and he started to try to add some more people. And instead of being the way most wholesalers do it, is you pick your customers fairly carefully, so that you don't get people who don't pay, and you know, you want steady as you go customers. Well, he relaxed his requirements a whole lot. And then he took on some new products that he didn't think were very good, but he figured that, well, with the new products, he could stuff all of his customers, all of his retailers, with inventory, which he did. And so what it showed was that over an 18-month period, or a little less than that, he had a very rapid growth. And the way most small businesses are sold, it is three times whatever your yearly earnings were. Well, he had some very rapid growth, and so he could sell it for, instead of three times, four times earnings, and earnings that were higher than they really ought to be. And he told me this story, what he did, and I said, well, what's going to happen when they figure out what happened to him? He said, well, they may be able to pay. I've got two-thirds of the money now, and they may be able to pay the last third, and if they don't, I'll just foreclose, take it over, and build it up and do it again. And I thought, oh, boy, do I not want that guy around. So I told him that, well, instead of being able to supply him with a boat in 4 months, we had just gotten to sign some big orders, and it would probably be better than a year. And so I knew he would go buy elsewhere, which I guess he did, but he didn't buy from me because I had no interest in selling that dude. Because I knew what would happen. At some point, he would manufacture some kind of fault, and I'd end up in court, and it would be a sad deal. So I didn't, I missed the sale, but I missed the sale that some deals are best left unmade, and that one was best left unmade.
You missed the sale, but you missed the lawsuit as well. So
I definitely did that, and I was sure that's what was going to happen. Now, maybe it wouldn't have, but not worth the heartache. I mean, I've been in court, and I didn't want any more of that action. Thank you very much.
And had you gone ahead, even though you had misgivings about the guy, you would have ultimately, if he did, in fact, sue you and take you to court for something, you would have been kicking yourself and had the premonition and acting on it.
Yep.
You know? But there was another.
I sure would have.
There was another one, Professor, where there was a lady, and I don't know why, maybe I'm getting my principles confused here. I think it was a boat, and it was the color. She didn't like the color of the boat, or she wanted to paint it a particular color, and it looked.
Yeah,
like
she wanted. There was one of those to her husband who was selling the boat, and she wanted it to be painted purple, and yachts, offshore fishing yachts, are not painted purple. They're painted white. And if they're painted some oddball color like that, it's not saleable, resaleable. And she wanted that, and so I just I backed off of that one too. I mean, I could sell all the boats we could make, and I didn't want to. I didn't have any desire to get myself entangled in a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So
everybody
I didn't.
Now. This next principle that we're going to talk about, in principle 49, all of the principles are good, mind you. Let me just tell you, all right, all of them are good. But this next one, I mean, this principle alone is worth the price of 5 books, okay? So, and more. So you definitely want to pay attention to this one. And if you don't remember anything that is said today, okay, again, remember this, okay? Principle 49, settle disputes by binding arbitration, not, and I repeat, not in court. Professor?
Yeah, the one of the things that if you're in business long enough, you're going to get sued. And some businesses, you get sued more than others. When I was selling airplanes, I got sued way more than when I was selling yachts. It's just kind of, for some reason, it's the nature of airplanes. And people will take you to court or take any airplane dealer to court, and they will allege the craziest damn things you ever heard of, and very often win. I mean, it is remarkable. For some reason, the faster a vehicle goes, the safer it's supposed to be. And anybody with an IQ above 10 understands that the faster it goes, the less safe it is. And I don't care what you're talking about. A motorcycle is way more dangerous than a bicycle. And
right.
The faster you go, you start riding the bicycle down a very steep hill, and it gets more and more unsafe the faster you go.
Right.
So the binding arbitration is when I was in the airplane business, I was averaging probably 3 lawsuits a year. Now, I never lost one, but
mm-hmm.
I was in California, and it was kind of a blood sport out there that people would sue aircraft dealers, and you'd get a lawsuit, and they'd say, well, we're suing you for $500,000. And this was 30 years ago when $500,000 was a lot of money. And what would happen is then they would say after about 2 weeks or 2 months, and you were beginning to get ready to start depositions and all of that serious stuff, they would say, well, instead of $500,000, we'll just settle for $100,000, pay us $100,000, we'll go away. Well, in California, it would cost pretty close to half of that to just pay your own attorney bills. And so, you know, if you lost, well, then you'd still have to pay your attorney bills, but then you'd have to pay you might have to pay their attorney. And no telling what you'd have to pay, but it would be darned expensive. And then if you still back down, then very often they'll say, well, look, why don't we just call it $50,000, we'll go away. Well, it was going to cost more than $50,000 in many cases just to pay your attorneys. Certainly today it would cost way more. And they'd keep working it down, and what would usually happen is at some point people would say, okay, you're down to $25,000. I know I'm going to have to pay my attorney $25,000. So here's the $25,000 and go away, and then you'd have another 10 or 15, whatever you'd built up with your attorney. And I had a situation where we had an old airplane, and when I sold it, it was an old twin, and I sold it to a guy, and I said, look, we're selling it to you for $9,000. It has a blue book value of almost twice that, but it's an old airplane, and you're going to have problems. I mean, it's just now it has a airworthiness certificate, so it's legal to fly, but it's still 25 years old, and that means the wiring is 25 years old, and the rivets are 25 years old. Everything on it is 25 years old. Now, the engines may have been rebuilt, but the whole airplane is old. And so I would recommend you take it to a mechanic and have him go over it. And if you find that it looks like there's going to be too much cost, well, come back to me. And I wrote right in the contract that he had 2 weeks to take it to a shop, have it go over. And if for any reason, if the sun came up in the east and he said, I don't want it, I will give you all your money back, every dime back. And so 3 weeks later, he came back and he said, there's a lot of mistakes on this airplane, a lot of things we have to have done. Looks like he gave me a very long list. And it looked like it cost $100,000 to do that. Mm-hmm. So I said, hey, you're over your time, but I don't care. I'll give you all your money back. He said, oh, no. You're going to have to fix all this. So I called my attorney, and he said, just tell him that we'll send him a check. And the next day I got a lawsuit, and my attorney sent him a certified check from the attorney's account, so it was no question to be good, and the guy sent it back. And a year later, we got out of court. Now, we won, and on the courthouse steps, I said to my attorney, if this isn't good enough, what, pray tell, is good enough? I mean, I offered to give him back his money. I even offered, we sent him a check that gave him back all his money and paid for the inspection.
Mm-hmm.
So he was out nothing, and it still wasn't good enough. And he told me, binding arbitration. So the way you do it is you put it in your agreement, and you have where you write up all the agreement, you sign at the bottom of the agreement, you date it, everybody signs it, and then below that there is a binding arbitration statement, and see if I can find it here. Oh, I guess I can't. But the binding arbitration is you say that any problems, that any disputes from this agreement by either party will be adjudicated by binding arbitration, not in court, and you have the person sign it, you sign it, it's all in very big print, it's the last thing on the contract, and there is no small print. This is in big print. So if you had your contract was in 12 font, you'd do this in 14 font and bold, and then you'd sign it. Well, I had been averaging 3 lawsuits a year, and from the date, and it, what happened is when he told me that, he wrote this up for me. We put it on the new contracts. We got rid of all the old contracts, and from that date, I was never, ever sued, not once.
I'd have asked my attorney, listen, man, you sure told me this 5 lawsuits too late. I could have saved a lot of money.
Yeah, he could have, but quite frankly, I've told this to other people, and they have gone to their attorneys, and their attorneys have said, nah, you don't really need that. The reason they don't need it is because the attorney knows that eventually they're going to get sued, and he'll defend it, I think. I mean, I hate to be such a hard rump about it, but I think that's frankly the truth.
So anybody who refuses to sign a contract with that binding arbitration language in it at the bottom, then it's probably safe to say that that person would you say that that person maybe had another motive, maybe possibly even to court?
Yep, because it saves them money, it saves everybody money. You can still sue, but you have to go to binding arbitration. Now, people who know, the reason I didn't get sued is I had lots of people say, well, you did this and that, and I'm going to sue you. And I said, well, fine, except our contract was binding arbitration. So you could sue me, but it has to be adjudicated by arbiters. And I know what happened. They take it to their attorney and show their attorney, and their attorney says, well, sure, I'll sue Geiger. He's rich. We'll get him good. However, because it's binding arbitration, there is no possibility that the court will force him to pay for me. So I can't do this on the basis of, at the end of the trial, well, then we'll settle up. So you need to give me $25,000 as a retainer. And
right. All
of a sudden, he doesn't want to sue anymore. That's what
mm-hmm.
happened. And I know mm-hmm. it's happened because that's the requirement. In binding arbitration, you can sue for actual damages, but you cannot sue for non-damages. Because they want to you say, well, I'm going to sue him for $10,000 of actual damages and $2 million for marbles and chalk because he's basically
right.
a bad guy and we're going to teach him a lesson. You can't do that. You can sue for actual damages, but they have to be provable.
Well,
so
the
all the money goes out. That's what happens, and it pretty well guarantees that you won't get sued. Now, if you did something really wrong, well, you will get sued, but they can only sue you for actual damages. They can't sue you for compensatory, as is the word that they use, and compensatory means because of what you did, I had headaches, and my child also had headaches and cried at school. So mm-hmm. we want to get you for $1 million for that. You can't do that,
mm-hmm.
and you cannot add.
Is that what they call it, pain and suffering?
Yeah, pain and suffering. Compensatory is what it's really called, but pain and suffering. You can't sue for pain and suffering, and you can't put your attorney's costs in there. In the binding arbitration, each litigant pays their own costs. So,
wow, this is a no-brainer here. I mean, this is what
absolutely.
This is a no-brainer principle.
Yep.
I mean, if you don't do it after hearing this.
Yeah, and also, if on the other side, if I did something really wrong, it wouldn't cost very much to go to binding arbitration. The costs for both parties are way down. So everybody wins. I mean, if there's a crook involved, he will have to pay for actual damages, and your attorney fees will be much lower than if you go to court. It's just the nature of it.
Well, Professor, who are the arbiters? Who are the people that are
generally speaking, binding arbitration, you need to specify who. That's why I say go to my book and read about it, because it says and you in that we specified I picked the American Arbiters Association, and so they pick three judges. You get to pick one, the other side gets to pick one. And the two judges together get to pick a third.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's the way that goes. And you need to say in it where the arbitration should be held. So The way I did it, I was in California, so it had to be held in Long Beach, California. And so they can't say, okay, yeah, we'll do this, but it needs to be in Tahiti. And, you know, no, I don't think so. So if you're here in Richmond, Virginia, where we are, it would be in it'd be held in Richmond, Virginia. Now, I've been to one arbitration, and it was done on the telephone.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the person could be almost anywhere. But that's the way that was, because they were a long way apart. And I wasn't a party of that, but I was, you know, I just knew the person. And I had been the one who told him to put in that in the contract, and it went sour. And so, but he won. And they couldn't prove damages, and they certainly couldn't prove that he did anything wrong. Here's the statement. The parties to this agreement agree that any and all disputes between the parties will be settled by binding arbitration conducted by the American Arbitration Association in Long Beach, California, not in court.
Okay, so that again, that's an example of an arbitration.
An example of a binding arbitration statement. Another thing you should want to do is make it simple. If your attorney gives you 4 pages to put in there, say, no, we've got to boil this down, because basically, if you are a business person and you're dealing with supposed non-business people, when I sold airplanes, virtually everybody who bought it owned a business of one sort or another. But nevertheless, if we'd have had a convoluted thing, they could say, well, Geiger is a business person. He understands all this legal mumbo jumbo, but I'm just a poor little schmuck out here, and I don't understand any of it, and he tricked me.
Mm-hmm.
Well, with the statement that we have here that I just read to you, it's pretty hard to make that case. You can't. There's nothing very tricky about it. It just says that anything that arose from anything in this agreement will be settled by binding arbitration, the American Arbitration Association in Long Beach, California, not in court.
Hmm.
So that's plain and simple. Keep it simple. There is time to be convoluted, but this is not one of them.
And I guess for people to say, to claim in court, let's say, for example, somebody gets sued and they had not signed a binding arbitration agreement, and
mm-hmm.
they found out in the interim during the time, you know, during the whole court proceedings that they could have signed one and should have signed one, it's too late at that point. I mean, you can't and say, had I known, you know, I would have signed a binding arbitration agreement.
Yeah.
So you can't go in there and say
nope.
Ignorance, you know, ignorance is not an excuse. Ignorance of the law
nope.
is no excuse, right?
Absolutely not.
Go in there and say, well, I didn't know. Had I known, I would have signed it and expected to work out for you.
Yeah, no, you sign what you signed. It's either there or it's not there. And you don't want to sign it in little print at the bottom. You want to sign it in big print. You want it to really, really stand out. And you want to keep it simple. Now, the words that I used here are not necessarily the ones that you should use. But if you talk to your attorney, you should make sure that whatever it is very simple. And nobody can say, well, I'm not a big businessman. I don't understand these litigation things. And so the wherefores and what fors, you don't put those in there. You know, you write it in simple English. And keep it simple, keep it short. And you can cover everything.
Well, speaking of signing, do we have time to get it in writing when everybody's happy?
Yeah, that's pretty simple because when you first put things together, whether you're starting a business and you have people that you, you know, are your, well, not partners, but your stockholders, and make sure that you get it all in writing and get it when they're happy, because they may not necessarily be happy the rest of their lives. And it may have absolutely nothing to do with what you're, you know, what you're doing. So I strongly recommend that you get it in writing. If you're in a discussion with somebody, an older man who's, well, he was about my age now when I knew him, and I was just a 30-year-old, and he was in his late 70s. I'm 81 now. And he told me, I used to take him whenever we went to negotiations for something. I was a boat salesman, but I also had owned businesses. And so he mm-hmm. took me on as kind of a surrogate son. And I used to drive him around, and we'd go to these things. And my job was to drive there and to sit in the background and keep my ears and eyes open and my damn mouth shut. And I watched Mr. Ashby in these things, and he would make notes. And then at the end of the meeting, he would go over his notes. So this is what we agreed. Boom, 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 boom. And anybody find fault with that? And then at the end of that, as soon as he went home, he'd have a secretary type up what was there, and he would send it around. And he said he did that I know he did it all the time when I was around him. And it certainly wasn't that Mr. Ashby had any memory problems. He may have been in his late 70s, but he was one very sharp, sharp cookie. He remembered it word for word. And he wrote it down that way. And then everybody, he'd send it around, and he'd ask them to make comments. And he'd always send two copies, one for them and one that they could make changes on and send back, so that everybody agreed. And that just made it so he just never had problems. And Mr. Ashby had been in the oil field business in the 20s when lots of big drilling contracts, and he was a driller, were done on a handshake. But he said even then he would make notes, and he'd send the notes. He didn't send the contract for him to sign, because back then in the oil patch, if you did that, you were telling the person that he was a crook, and they took big umbrage to that. You know, don't want to do that. But he said, I always sent him some notes that I wrote, and in that case, they weren't typed out. I would take what I had home. And I would, actually, he got his wife to write him, because she had beautiful handwriting. And there were handwritten notes, and he would send it there and did the same thing. So sent two notes, two copies, one for them to keep and one to send back if they had a problem. And it was all in his handwriting then, or you know, actually his wife's. He said, I just didn't have problems. Others had problems. I didn't have problems. And that's why.
What about when it comes to family in particular? Because, you know, family, people know each other, love each other. And, you know, there may be some people who have either experienced this or will experience this going into business with family. First of all, speaking of that, do you recommend that? Do you recommend
no.
people, families, go into business with each other? I'm sure if there have been probably families that have broken up, split up, don't talk anymore because of some business dealing that they had that went wrong. First, do you recommend business and family?
No, absolutely not. A dear friend or a family, being in business with them is a problem. Now, you may still want to do it, but if you do it, make sure that you get in writing how things are going to be and who the boss is and who the boss is not, so that you really have it in writing and spelled out, and just say, look, I don't want to be a hard rear end about this, but I also don't want to have problems. And sometimes, I mean, you know, you have your this great friend of yours or a family member, and then they have a son who's a drugger, and they want their son to be the sales manager for your company. And,
right.
You know, and this was never contemplated when it was first put together. But here we are. And he really wants to have his son. His son can't get a job, so he's going to get a job as a sales manager in your company and destroy it. I think not. So, you know, there are just so many things that can happen that are totally unforeseen. And if you have the basics down, who's in charge and who isn't, then there's a better chance that that this will work out. But I do not recommend that wives or husbands or good friends or worse yet family members are in your company. I think that's, you're just asking for trouble. You'll get enough trouble without asking for it.
It's got to be very difficult. Hopefully, you know, in business, you don't want to be in a situation where you have to sue anyone, you know.
Yeah.
Hopefully. But it could be twice as hard to sue a family member, even if, you know, even if you know that you would win if you sued them, even if you got everything in writing and as a result of that, you had an ironclad case to sue them, you know, it could be very heart-wrenching, a very tough decision to do that.
Well, here again, this is an excellent time for having binding arbitration. So you get it all down, what you're going to do and what the agreement is, and then make sure that there's binding arbitration. Taking it to court, that's just going to – that would truly be a no-win deal. Regardless of how much you won, it's still going to be a no-win deal because the family is going to get wrenched apart. You just do not want to do that. And so, yeah.
Well, Professor, we've got to tell the people how they can get your book. I mean, because, again, this is a book that has got all kinds of examples in it. I mean, you're just getting, when you're listening to this show and you're listening to Professor and I talk about the book, you're getting a lot of good information. But imagine if you got all of the examples that Professor gives in the book along with the principle. Okay, so we want to tell you how you can get this book and tell you about another book that Professor has, Finding a Career for Life. Professor, why don't you tell them how about the other book first and then tell them how they can get both.
Okay, the Finding a Career for Life is just a little book. It sells for $10, less than $10, and you can get it at from me at Joe Geiger at theroadtothetop.com. And or just go to theroadtothetop.com, and that gets you into my website, and you can get it there, both of them there. The bigger one, Entrepreneurial Success, is 360-some pages, so it's a pretty hefty little book. And it's $18 or so. And so the two of them are there, or you can get them at Amazon. If you go to Amazon, you'll need to use Entrepreneurial Success, 105 Business Principles. And the reason for that last bit, 105 Business Principles, are there. When I first wrote this, there were no other entrepreneurial successes. But since I wrote it, there's a whole bunch of them. And so you, instead of wading through those, you can, if you put in 105 Business Principles, well, then you'll go right to it. And get that. The one thing you, when we first started, you were talking about me and you said experience is the best teacher. Actually, that is one of the oldest sayings there is, and it was originally written, I believe, by a Chinese philosopher and general. His name is Sun Tzu, and he wrote a book called The Art of War. Some 2,500 years ago, it's far and away the oldest book in continuous production. It's always been available. Originally, it was written in Chinese figures on bamboo, on a bamboo scroll. and it's still available. It's a wonderful, wonderful little book. It's only about 47 pages long, but he wrote, and some of the principles that I have, some of them I thought I thought them up myself, and then I wrote I read this little the Art of War, and I found out that Sun Tzu wrote them down 2,500 years before I did. So I think he beat me to them.
Dealing with the same issues.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, a lot of this stuff just doesn't change. And I'm talking to a college now about teaching some and about entrepreneurship. And for college students, almost half of all college students, before they die, will become entrepreneurs. Of just plain folks who work for a living and make money, according to the IRS, a third of those, over a third of those now, will be entrepreneurs before they stop their income years. And so, and the entrepreneurial skills are ancient. They just don't change. Now, what you're actually doing may change, but the principles don't change. They're constant.
Wow. Well, everybody, we want you to know that this book and these books, actually, even the other book that the professor touched on, Finding a Career for Life, if you think about what you're going to get when you get these books, and you then you think about the cost of each or both of the books, you would be absolutely, the only word I can think of is flabbergasted when you think of what a deal you are actually getting when purchasing these books. I mean, just even speaking of Finding a Career for Life, I mean, you can save yourself and or a loved one, a friend, or something, a lot of time. We're going to have to come back and we'll do that show. We'll go through that book again, too, because, again, that book is full of a lot of information that you can really, really benefit from. As a matter of fact, I invite you to scroll down the archives, and I'm sure that there are shows that we did on Finding a Career for Life in the archives, and you can listen to those shows. And again, you'll want to get the book because it's got to be constantly updated. I think, Professor, you mentioned that you're in the process of updating it again this year.
Yep. Yeah, I do it every year.
So everybody, we want make sure you got to, you know, the information keeps changing yearly, annually, so you want to make sure last year's information is not going to do you any good. So you want to make sure that you get the updated version of that book. Again, Professor, thank you so much again for being my guest. Again, Professor comes on every other Tuesday. Again, this is the first show on Health, Wealth, and Divine for this year, not just for Professor Geiger, but for any of the other shows. And so we're back. So, again, Professor, we'll be back on, and then we'll pick up with the next principle, which will be, if you don't run it like a corporation, it isn't a corporation.
That's
so I know everybody you want to look at. Professor, any parting words for our listeners today?
No, not at all. Look up the two. The little book, the Finding a Career for Life, is really, I wrote that because I had so many students who came in and who were older, in their 30s or so, who had gone to college, gotten a degree, and then found out when they got out and they had invested all this money and time and effort, found out that there were no jobs for that particular skill set. And in most cases, I could tell them that to start with. If you go to college for 4 years, you can get a degree in social work, and you may come out with a $30,000-$40,000 in debt, and you may be able to find a job for $35,000 a year, or you can go and have the same amount of debt and come out as a petroleum engineer and get a job that within a very few years you'll be pushing $200,000 as an average person. Right now, it's $186,000 is the average midterm, midlife, mid-career income. Costs you the same, costs 4 years in both cases, costs the same amount of dollars to go to college. The difference is in one case you make $180,000 plus, and in the other, maybe if you're lucky, you make $40,000. All for the same thing.
Interesting. Well, you know what's interesting is that they don't put a scale, a cost scale, it appears, on what courses. They're not making any judgment. You know, all of the courses cost the same. It's going to cost you the same to go for petroleum engineering as it does if you went for art. You know?
Correct.
You know,
yep, so and that's the case, and I've taken this book to a number of liberal arts colleges, and they in one case a local one here, or a fairly local one here in Richmond, and the person who ran the bookstore bought one of the books herself, but she said the management of the school would not allow her to stock the book because they didn't want the students to see it. And the reason is because they wanted the students to continue to get their degrees in psychology and God knows what else. They knew full well that there were no jobs for many of those majors, not any jobs at all. Psychology is one. If you get a PhD, you may be able to find a job teaching, or you may be able to find a job as a big corporation. But at any rate, you'll be lucky to make $75,000. But as far as having a master's or a bachelor's or associate degree as a psychologist, there are no jobs for that, period.
Wow.
They just don't exist.
And the
blasted teachers and colleges know it, and they keep telling these young people to take the... It's sad. It's very sad.
You know, I was just thinking, it just reminds me of one of your principals, Professor. All decisions should be data-driven.
Yep.
You know, so
they should
keep
be.
That in mind for getting the book. Professor,
Sun Tzu wrote that, too.
Oh, did he?
Yes, sir. Sun Tzu wrote that.
Okay. I'm going to get that book, too.
Yeah.
I've read it before. But it's been a long time. I was going to revisit that one.
Okay.
Professor, thank you so much for your time.
It's been, as always,
a joy, a pleasure, a learning experience talking to you. And I look forward to speaking with you again. Everybody, again, mark your calendar. Professor will be back in 2 weeks, a special guest from 7 to 8. And we thank him for his time. Professor, I'll talk to you soon.
Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Great show. Everybody, that is Professor Joseph Geiger, author of the awesome book, Entrepreneurial Success, The Road to the Top 105 Business Principles. And you can also, again, get his other book, Finding a Career for Life. Go to www.theroadtothetop.com. Again, my name is Jawanza. Again, we're back. Again, took a little slight break for the holidays, and so we're back. And so get ready for some more powerful shows. Again, this is Health, Wealth, and Divine, so you know we're going to be talking about your health, we're going to be talking about your wealth, and we're going to be talking about your divinity. So, again, thank you so much for your time. Again, my name is Jawanza. Who am I? I'm the one who, in giving, receives more. Who are you? That's that.